Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. Reason number one is networking. The opportunity to connect in person with like-minded recruitment business owners and share strategies and best practices. Of course, you can do that via Zoom or Teams, but the connection is deeper when you do it in real life. Wouldn't you agree? One of our previous attendees, Darcy, said that she loved the speakers and the content, but the best part for her was in between the sessions, the informal conversations with other successful business owners that sparked incredible insights and those aha moments. The quality of people in the room will be incredible, including many of the people you've heard me interview on this podcast. There's going to be big billing recruiters as well as business owners with multi-million pound businesses. What they all have in common is that they prioritize their own development. And no matter how successful they already are, they want to keep learning and growing. What's even more special and remarkable about this group is that they're all willing to share their knowledge and they're so generous at helping each other improve. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by Pri Sarkar. Pri is the founder and director of Switch Recruitment. He enables startups and scale-up SaaS companies to scale their teams in APAC. LinkedIn rated him as a top 1% recruiter. Amazon rated his book Switch as a number one bestseller in the careers and job hunting category. He's a member of the Pinnacle Society, a select group of industry-leading recruiters globally. Pri, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Mark, thank you so much. I'm so excited to join you today.
Awesome. By the way, I've ordered your book on Amazon, but I have to admit I've not read it yet. It's on its way.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to that. So let me just set the scene here, because you referred to me by multiple Pinnacle Society members, namely right. Michelle Parchman and Kathy Stewart are ones I know. I'm sure I've been given your name by others as well, but they've both been on the show as well. And I always ask my guests, who else I should interview? Because I'm, you know, great people know great people, right? It's the same in recruiting. You know, networking is how you find that, you know, that talent. When your name came back, I was like, I know that guy. Because we worked together back in 2015. From the looks of it, we've both come a long way since then. You've changed your company name, you've published a book, you've become a trusted advisor in a crowded space, which I'd love to get into because you're doing some fantastic things. First, could you just briefly talk about your decision to become a recruiter? It's amazing how many people start a recruitment business with no industry experience and, you know, apart from maybe interviewing for their own department when they worked in cubicle land. And some people buy a franchise and others just think, how hard can it be? And they just jump in. And so you were the country sales director at FedEx. Why did you think starting a recruitment business would be a good idea or even something you wanted to do?
Well, I think the desire was sown in my heart a long time back, but the timing was never right because I kept climbing in my career with FedEx. And then the decision was made for me because on the eve of the GFC, we got called into an office and they shut down 4 locations in Asia, the division that I worked for. And I found myself heading back in, you know, a taxi home, telling my wife that, you know, I didn't have a job. So that was the genesis point. And from that point onwards, I think, you know, the way I see things is that no matter how dark it is in the valley, a divine whisper or serendipity can change the course of your life. And that's what happened to me. It was the first... the first 3 months were really hard. We had 2 kids under 5. It was, a single income family. And we had bought a house not 12 months back and broken the piggy bank and thrown it away. So, but from that point, once you've gone through that, everything else in retrospect seems easier.
What a wonderful way of framing that, Pri. And by the way, for listeners outside Australia, GFC is global financial crisis, right? That's what you guys called the Great Recession in 2008. And I love the way that in retrospect, what seemed like a disaster and, you know, a real putting your family's financial security in jeopardy turned out to be a serendipitous moment, which has led you to bigger and better things that you may not have taken this direction if, you know, if you hadn't lost your job at FedEx. So sometimes you don't know if it's your best day or your worst day at the time. It's only with hindsight that you can really evaluate things properly. I also had a rough time during 2008, and I also had a young family and a mortgage that, you know, it was scary time. So then since then, after the first 3 months, which were hard, you started, you know, getting some results and the business started doing well. And I'm sure there was many ups and downs in the, you know, in the road after that. But what do you feel have been the key inflection points in your business that have kind of led to this real success that you're having now?
I think that when we got made redundant, I was in an incredibly, it was such a surprise because I had taken a sales team from 80% performance over the last 3 years from when I started in 2005 to 130% in 2008. So we had gone from a level three to a premiership team, which was doing exceptionally well. And the last thing you would expect was for the business to be disbanded. So the first thing that I did was I actually helped these guys and girls get a job. So I, you know, called as many people as I knew, gave as many references, sold as hard as I could and helped people get jobs. Started figuring out what we were going to do. The first thing was to write to the bank and say that I actually couldn't afford my mortgage. Moving fast forward, just really figuring what I could do. And being a sales manager, the first thing I did was actually reach out to a couple of small business owners who in the past, we had one person who met me at a breakfast and said, "You sound really passionate. Come and help me with sales." So I called John and I said, "Hey, John, do you still want some advice?" He was like, "Sure, come on over." And that was the genesis inflection point where he said, "My business is stuck in the 80s. They were a very successful but stagnant business." And my first 12 months was just consulting, listening to problems. And if I could just put three, you know, underlines, when you just listen to problems and you want to solve things and help people, the magic happens, right? Regardless of the situation. So that was one. I saw that I was doing a lot of coaching, training. And when I realized that they were having a problem finding good salespeople, I was like, hang on, I know how to find good salespeople because I had learned to reach out to some of the best salespeople with the competition or out there in the market and really nurture some relationships. So that was a very natural transition, having been the salesperson, having been the sales manager, to actually start headhunting salespeople, not depending on job ads. And that was probably the most natural leap I made into that next season. So that was one. And fast forward a couple of years, I then, you know, really had to start to build a team and then basically go from there. So I'd say in four stages, I think, number one, learning how to just listen with empathy and care and solve problems. You know, you will find solutions. So learning to listen, learning to sell, learning to lead, and learning to build. Those were the four distinct inflection points in my journey.
Love that. Great structure. Thank you. It sounds like the listening and the empathy was something you already had, right? And so it was just applying that in a new field. but one that in now that you've described that journey, it does seem like it was a natural fit because you were already headhunting and recruiting salespeople for your own team. You then applied that to your client companies. Talk about learning. So then learning to sell, but you, again, you already had a sales background, but so it was just learning in this new context. What was the change in your approach to selling when you started your search firm?
Mark, learning how to sell with FedEx on your business card versus learning from your backyard with, you know, in your laundry room, trying to sound like a professional with the neighbor starting up their lawnmower and the dog barking.
Okay. Tell me more about that. I don't understand the analogy.
Right. So I went from a high street office with the FedEx brand,
yep,
which did 90% of the work, if not 99% of the work. That was easy. To, you know, starting my own company. Who are you? Where are you from? Why should I listen to you?
Right.
I think there is a world of difference when you've got to put food on the table and you don't have a brand behind you. So that was my point. And I actually did have all of those. You know, I've been making calls to get some business and the neighbors started their lawnmower or the dog's been barking and, you know, there's like, oh,
I see. Literally, like you're trying to do business to them and the dog's barking.
That's right.
Right. Hilarious. So what was the key takeaway or learning from that evolution from selling with a big brand behind you where people are, they're sort of buying into you, but they're mainly buying into the brand, to the other opposite where they've never heard of your company and you have to build that trust from scratch?
I think the number one thing is that, and it took me a little while because I've tried so many different scripts which didn't work. I think you've got to see the value in yourself that you are bringing to people and then be able to show that value because people will pay for value that they can see. So when I call a sales VP and say, I'm one of the rare few recruiters who's been a quota-carrying sales rep, a sales manager, and I now recruit salespeople for other people like you, that's a soundbite that's loaded with value and I don't need a big brand name.
Okay, great. Good insight. That's like, you learn so much when you're scrappy and you have to like fight for every piece of business, right? And you're like actually putting food on the table is at stake. It's, you know, it's a sort of trial by fire. So then so what's the timeline here? So 2008, you started and then getting to the point where you were getting traction in the market, you were winning customers and then moving on to stage three, learning to lead. What was that time frame before you started growing your team?
So it took me about 3 to 5 years, Mark. I've listened to your Big Biller Summits as long as you've had them around. So I've bought everything that you've had, you know, even before I could afford a coaching fee, right?
Wow, that's cool.
That goes back a long time.
That is a long time ago.
Right. So the point that I was making was that it took me about 2.5 years where I was consulting. Basically, I would, you know, coach business owners or sales managers or general managers of companies, whatever, put food on the table, coaching, training, and I started recruiting probably at the end of my first year. And at that time, it was survival mode. It was pretty much year one was half what my corporate salary was. But by the end of the second year, it was 2.5 times. So at that point, I was really busy and I was earning well. And I had to think about, what do I really want to do? Do I want to be a lifestyle recruiter?
Mm-hmm.
And my passion was with building and leading teams, because when I look back, that was something that came naturally. So I moved into niching and specializing. So from an individual for the first 2.5 years who was doing a number of different things, I had coaching clients and training clients and some recruiting clients, I said thanks and just focused on the recruiting. And then that doubled over the next 2 years. So, you know, I wish it was 3 months or 6 months. I hear some people who just take off like rockets.
Yeah.
Maybe it's, having said that, that's really where we went with the next phase. And really, it all came from doing it myself, getting to that next stage, you know, finding the resources and then getting my first researcher. You know, I had to get someone who was helping me with a lot of the data and the I was always in it for the conversations with people that I love and enjoy. The, you know, the back end stuff is always an effort. So we went with a researcher and then from a researcher to a researcher and a recruiter. But I have always been the client advisor. You know, that is my moment of flow. I could do that from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. with my eyes closed and enjoy every moment of it. So, yeah.
Fantastic. There's a few little golden nuggets I just want to highlight in what you just said. So, first of all, specialization. So, what year did you really focus in on like IT and software sales as your niche?
I think it took me about 3 to 4 years.
Okay.
And it was a transition because I realized that I used to be an account executive for an Oracle consulting partner in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so that was a very easy conversation. And as I started targeting software companies, you know, and, you know, it was not like, hey, thanks for calling us. They're like, who are you? Who else are you working with? So today, if you ask me, I'd drop, you know, an Amazon and a Microsoft and the latest chatbot company, they'd be like, wow, that's great. Back then I had no one else, you know,
right.
You know, so they're like, you know, and it's just really interesting how things have worked out. So it was a gradual process where I was just doing sales for any company through to winning my first software company account, you know, making some great placements, earning the right to use them as a reference, expand. So it was that was the process.
Great.
So special niche, number one niche, and then specializing within my efforts, which was identifying that I was best with clients, generating business and serving and advising, and then, you know, finding other people who were really good at research and recruitment so that the sum was greater than the parts.
Right. Exactly. I want to move on to that because the first, you niched down from recruiting just any type of salespeople to salespeople within software. But then the next evolution was recognizing what your strengths are and then building a support structure so that you can be in flow. You're working with clients, advising clients, in the sort of, you know, account manager capacity, and you're supported by a researcher who's, you know, sourcing, putting, you know, the candidate list together, and then a recruiter, presumably, who's then working with those candidates to qualify them to present opportunities and so on, and then bringing them to you. And then you can focus on what you're best at, and that's going to allow you, as you said, sum is greater than the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That allows you to increase your overall billing. So that's fantastic. And that's such a valuable, I think there's a few people, and I've interviewed many of them on my show, who can be purely solo, you know, big billers.
Yeah.
That's definitely not me. I don't think it's replicatable. Like, I think there's a few unique human beings who can do this all by themselves, and they do like everything themselves, and they can still perform at a high level. But I think it's the surer way to success is the way that you've done it, which is focus on what you're best at, and then hire people with complementary, you know, skills and who like doing different things to. And then as a team, you can perform at a very high level.
Yes, I think that has been a pivotal change in what I did, because I tried being a solo, and I was a solo for the good 5 years, but over a period of time, when you're working 12 hours, you're still on when you get home.
Yeah.
You know, you're stressed out most of the time. You're either delivering on jobs and you don't have new jobs, you go after new jobs, and then, you know, you blank out a quarter. It's just, it's hard. You know, you're constantly watching, you know, do you have enough cash? And so it was a downward spiral. Though I was doing well, it was hitting the numbers, had great clients, but it was a bottleneck for me.
Right.
I had to get people in to keep up with the growing opportunity. And actually, the way I see it, you know, in the startup phase, you can fake it till you make it.
Yep.
But then with a bit of profit, you have to make it until you don't have to fake it anymore. Right?
So we are describing it. Yeah, totally. So like what you're describing, number one, the peaks and troughs is symptomatic of being a solo 360 degree recruiter. It's just so hard to be consistent when you're one person, because you're switching from business development mode, and then you get an opportunity, you want to maximize on that, you want to deliver for your customer, and you know, and also that's where the money is. You've now got this order you need to fulfill, and then you switch into recruiting, but then the pipeline dries up. And this is just such a common thing, which, you know, there's a variety of solutions to this, but I think the one that you've come up with is smart. So could you then describe your building phase, which, because you've gone through working through those feast and famine cycles for the first few years to now you've scaled to a team of 10 people. Could you describe, like, what is your business model and how has that evolved?
All right. So I think I've done it the wrong way the first time, every time, you know, in the beginning, I didn't have the cash. So I tried to obviously get in people who would work on commission, and that didn't work because there is a level of integrity that I want to operate with, and very short-term mindsets just lead to bad outcomes. So that was an immediate values clash. And on a side note, my big aha only after 25 years in the industry is that all friction comes down to values. So if you're clear about your values, building a team gets a lot easier because you can recognize that. So we went from that to hiring people who were a good match on values, wanted the same things that we wanted. You invested in them, and they stayed and they loved it. So in essence, today, the team that we have, the structure is I've got three what I call practice managers, because we don't just recruit for sales. We recruit for all go-to-market functions: sales, pre-sales, channel, marketing, professional services. And each of the team leaders focus on one of the functional areas, and they have a recruiter and a researcher on their team. So basically what I was doing as a team of three, the 360, it split down into 120, 120, 120, is what my three pods look like today. And so they're building that practice, and that works exceptionally well. It helps us to say yes to clients and deliver whatever talent pool that they're looking for in 5 to 10 working days.
Love it. Wow. Okay. So hang on a sec. I'm taking notes as we go along here, because I want to be sure to follow up on certain things. So you created the basic unit of your business as a team of a pod of three. And initially you were like the practice manager, the team lead and the kind of client liaison person. And then you had the researcher and the recruiter supporting you. And the way you've scaled is just by replicating that same basic unit. And now you've got three practice managers who basically you've promoted yourself and developed them into to replace you in that slot. And that allows you to then multiply to you're still managing three people directly.
That right? is correct.
But that gives you the leverage to be able to grow the team. It's smart. Why? So explain your 120 degree model and why you like that in particular.
I like that specifically because I believe that the number one skill that a recruiter can have is situational awareness. And right. when you look at, the three areas is who are the companies, what are the jobs, and who are the candidates? You really need, in my opinion, a researcher who lives and breathes all things that are data and information so that you, at any point of time, know who are the right clients, who are the right, where are the opportunities, and who are the right candidates for the job. You need to have a recruiter who is all day, every day, speaking to 20 plus candidates, pitching opportunities, ensuring that we are proactive outbound and, connecting with them. And then you need someone who is solely focused on the client ecosystem, which is, spending time with clients, with preps, debriefs, advising, listening, and then going after new clients, whether it's in a similar ecosystem or in new areas that we're trying to grow in. And that basically minimizes risk for everyone in the team. Because the one thing I learned as a unit of one is that if you have a new client and you discover that, either the hiring manager is not a good fit or the hiring process, that's one of two things that we grade our jobs on. A1 is a great hiring manager, great hiring process, and B2 is not so great hiring manager and not a great hiring. It's the close ratio on that is very low. So long story short, that specialization allows each person to really embrace that skill and build and get really, really good at that.
Love it. It makes total sense. So just to clarify, by the way, I want to get really granular now because we've talked about like conceptual ideas and kind of the journey, but this is what I always try and do, Pri, on this show is get actionable insights.
Yes.
And yes. that people, because then they not only get inspired by your story, but then they can actually apply some of what you've taken years and years to learn. So the researcher is in charge of all things data on the client and the candidate side. So they're just looking at building those data sets and mapping out the market, the client universe, as well as all the talent in their practice. So I guess it makes it manageable because they're only researching the candidates within that particular function, I guess. Am I understanding correctly?
Absolutely right.
Okay. So they're finding names, but also contact information, adding them to your database. So then you've got the recruiter whose their job is outbound and connecting, engaging, getting, relationships with those candidates, qualifying, but also, pitching opportunities, getting them interested in working with your client companies. And then you've got the practice manager whose job is to use the data that I guess the research is feeding data to both the recruiter and the practice manager. The recruiter then has to reach out to those candidates and connect with them. And the practice manager is doing the same on the client side. Am I on track so far?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You're absolutely right.
Question then, what are the metrics or the, what is the result that each of those three people is accountable for apart from billings that lets them know that they're being successful?
Yeah. So essentially in my team, we have soft targets around minimums and ideals, which is for each individual, we want to see a contribution of 20 placements in a year.
Okay.
And so typically at a 40% close ratio, so essentially for 20 placements, you would need to get 50 jobs. Yeah. So when it comes to let's start with the practice manager. The practice manager is responsible for managing a portfolio of clients that would, you could have 20 accounts or so with maybe 30 or 40 hiring managers and basically ensuring that they are spending a majority of time talking to them, identifying opportunities, and then prospecting for net new opportunities. So let's say I'm the practice manager. I call someone, connect with them. They said, yep, we're hiring. You know, can you help me? Yes, you can. Let's say it's a cybersecurity account executive. I then organize a briefing call. And at the briefing call in our team, I will have the recruiter, the researcher, and myself.
Smart. I want people to take note of that. This avoids like so many situations where things are lost in translation. You know, if you play this game, like I remember when having a birthday party, I was probably like 5 or 6. My parents organized a birthday party with all my little friends. And we played this game where you sit in a circle and you whisper something in the next person's ear and then they whisper it to the next person. And by the time it goes around the whole circle, it's completely different to what the original information was, right? So you get the recruiter, the researcher, everybody on that call. And that way they're hearing it directly and everyone's on the same page. I think that's smart. And if that's not possible, I recommend people record that conversation if it's a Zoom call or whatever. And then the researcher or whoever wasn't able to make that call, they can rewatch it.
Absolutely. And so it gives everyone the same information and that you're on the same page. And then from thereafter, the researcher will build out a list of candidates that we need to talk to from both our existing database. We've got 25,000 people, as well as LinkedIn, augmenting anyone who's come new or we know could be leaving or was not in our database. But basically, we want good data quality in the next first 2 days. In the first 2 days, we want a list of, say, 40 to 60 potential candidates, which then moves to the recruiter. The recruiter knows that 2 days from now, they will be recruiting on the job. They come in the morning and they will then action a 4-step campaign, which we call an E1, R1, E2, R2. It's an email or a LinkedIn message saying, you know, hey, Mark, wanted to make you aware. Let's go through the, high level pitch, 3 bullet points. Would you be open to having a conversation? So E1. Follow that up with a recruit call, high degree of personalization. Hey, Mark, we know 3 people from the company that you're currently working at or previously worked at. I can see you've done 1, 2, 3. This is an opportunity to just to get to know you, what you want, and discuss 1 or 2 potential opportunities. Let's have a conversation. So E1, recruit call. And at each stage, you get a percentage that come back. Yes, no, maybe. And then we do it again. So that's that's like a 6-day cadence. So 2 days for research, 6 days for outreach. And at the end of that, you should have, 3 to 5 potential candidates that you can introduce to the client. The recruiter will send it to the client and copy in the account manager. The account manager will drive the, we want to make sure that we get maximum interviews from that. So he or she will, call the client and have a conversation and get them over the line. The recruiter will organize and line up diaries and get everything happening. And that's the process.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that detailed description. So the researcher's metric is more around being able to deliver the long list of 40 to 60 relevant candidates within 2 days. Is that the...
That is correct. So
and then,
go ahead.
No, I was just wondering, is that keep them busy full time or do they have other, like in the background, they're doing other list building research kind of all the time as well? Or
yeah, I can't think of a time in the last, barring a couple of days before Christmas, where our researcher doesn't have the next job to go to.
Yeah.
So there's the next job and the next job and the next job. So essentially, the research, and I think to answer the bigger question that people might want to know, is that the researcher is bonused on the pod's ability to make placements, and the account manager gets a percentage or a bonus based on the contribution of the placement. the recruiter will get recognized on that. So we provide a compensation for every interview that happens, because that is a unit of value to the client,
yep,
as well as for the placement. So it drives a lot of good team behavior. The awesome. Three of them all rowing in the straight. There's no solos. There's no one thing I've learned is that for longevity and for low friction, there's mutual accountability between the three people. I haven't had to pull someone up on a conversation about, you know, not making lists quickly enough or not making enough calls or not getting.
That's smart. So it's really the incentives are based upon team working together to get the results.
That's right.
And which is smart, because nobody wants to let their team member down, be the one who, you know, was holding us back from making this placement, right? So if anything, it means people probably work harder than they would if it was just their own, themselves who stood to benefit. Go ahead.
And I was just going to say the value proposition to the client is we're structured like an executive search firm. We're not your contingency recruiter with one person trying to balance 12 jobs.
Yeah.
So if, and I say this, if we accept the assignment, so there is an if.
Good.
Because if we are one of five recruiters, I'm going to say thanks, no thanks.
Right.
Right. If we really want the account, it's got to be one of two recruiters until we can demonstrate that, because three are better than one any given day. You can get lucky, but we're given the same set of circumstances. You bring me a role and you've got someone who makes the best available list in the next 24 to 48 hours. You get someone, it's a relay team. They're going to outrun anyone on the same amount of distance. And it shows with the results. So that's what we tell clients, that if you engage us, you're actually getting three. You do not need two and three recruiters. You have got three recruiters, and we will give it to us for 2 weeks and see what we can do for you.
I love this, Pri. I've not heard that way of describing it before. So it's a relay team, which means that you can outrun any individual recruiter. But not only that, if the client has the argument, well, we need three recruiters on this, you say, well, we'll give you three recruiters just within one firm. That is so smart. I love that. Not heard that answer to that objection before. And I actually just want to circle back to two things that I didn't quite understand. One is, you said that they need to contribute to 20 placements a year. Does that mean, like, as a team, each practice needs to deliver 20 placements a year?
Well, if the practice is three people, the guidance
is 60.
We want to hit 60, and that's how it goes. And basically, if we are ahead of that, then the practice can hire another person in there, whether we need another researcher or another recruiter. So these are seedling practices, that practice could be five or seven people comfortably. It just, we've got that simple metric. So everything is around the placement, you know, billings average themselves out.
Okay.
And as a company, so for example, we made 113 placements last year. We sponsor a child for every placement we make. So we sponsor 113 kids in third world countries, which again, it goes beyond what's good for the client, good for the candidate, good for the team member, but also someone else. So
I saw that on your website. I think that's so powerful, because you're making a positive difference in the world, which is awesome, but also it just gives extra meaning to this job. The thing with, this is a hard job, right? It's the emotional highs and lows. It's tough. And then obviously you can make really good money, and that only gets you so far in terms of motivation, right? So what people also, especially younger people these days, are looking for meaning. They want to do something that, you know, has some kind of meaning. And so you're providing that as well, because not only by making these placements will they earn well, but also there's this other positive impact that they're helping to generate.
Yeah, look, I think that at a very basic level, there are three phases that, in my opinion, most people want, whether it's me or my team members. At one level, you want to survive.
Yep.
You want to succeed. and then you want to be significant, however you define for that. So it's that journey from survival to significance. So when I lost my job, my number one, you know, was put my oxygen mask on and feed my kids and look after my family, my wife.
Yes.
And, you know, so that was complete survival mode. It then became a focus on maximizing my productivity and billings. And when that happened, after a point, it started, it's hard. So, and the constant uncertainty, both from the client's end, you know, jobs go on hold. They, you know, we had a referral, you know, you all the dramas that are possible. Or with candidates, how many candidates have we come to a final offer stage and you feel like, yes. And it's like, I've had a counter offer, you know, and you've done all the interview training scripts. So that gets tiring. That gets very, very emotionally hard beyond a point. And even if I've had times when I've been billing exceptionally well and it still felt empty. It's like, okay, so what? So I think that making a difference, that has always been part of my fabric. You know, we as a family sponsored kids when I was at FedEx, but that was four kids. But the point is that when you can make a positive difference on every interaction, it just, you sleep really well.
Yeah,
regardless of.
love it. Priya, you're giving so much value. I almost can't keep up to the different threads here of this conversation. So, because there's two other things that you've just mentioned passing, by the way. So that's survival, success, and significance. I love that. It's a little bit like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but in a more succinct way. I like that. Is that your own idea or did you read that somewhere?
No. I went off to boarding school at the age of 9 and it was the hardest thing that ever happened to me.
Wow.
I spent 1 week straight crying every night. I missed mom and dad. They were 1,000 miles away. And over a period of time, you stop crying. You start figuring out, you know, everything was new people, new rules, new situation, and you take it one step at a time and you learn what you need to do. Once you do that and you make friends, you know how to work the system and you go from survival to success and, you know, did well, had losses, had wins, and then hopefully moved on. So I think that's been a theme in my life, whether I have lost a job and back to survival mode, get to success. And along the way, hey, if we can help other people, it just is a lot more fun. It's a lot more meaningful. And it's really nice. I called a VP and he said, Pri, I'm in a meeting, but I knew it was you. So I wanted to just take your call and say, I'll call you back. That wouldn't happen to me for my first 5 years. But I have made a contribution along the way to these people. And so that makes a difference.
Okay. I want to get into that very shortly, which is how you have become a real trusted advisor and thought leader in your space, because then that elevates everything too. Like you're already here and then that elevates things. That's when you really start to scale, right? And just before we do that, I love the grading system that you've got. We don't have time to go into it. Maybe that's for another day. But we encourage our clients to grade their jobs. If anyone wants to see our scorecard, they can go to recruitmentcoach.com/scorecard and you can download it for free. And it's just, we think nobody on your team should work a job until you've actually given it a numerical score based on a set of agreed criteria and either decided you could reject the job. Or, and I like how you say to the hiring manager, if we, you know, take on this search, or you could negotiate and try and upgrade the score, or you at least can then prioritize how much resource are we going to put into that. But what the elephant in the room here, which we've just skipped over because there were so many other good things coming, is you're delivering the shortlist within 5 to 10 days. Is that 5 to 10 working days? So within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's a very aggressive time frame, which I love. And I didn't see, like, you've obviously really refined your value proposition here, Pri, which, you know, I there are not many search firms who can deliver the shortlist within 5 to 10 days. So that is That is amazing. And I can see how it happens with the little pods and the machine that you've built and the team and the relay and on all those things. But it's powerful to be able to say that to a customer. So let's move on to something you've done phenomenally well, which is like really becoming that trusted advisor and what was that inflection point where things really took off? Cause like you've got the book and I believe you've also had a course and you've even won an award from the Australian government. Like when did all this happen?
A series of events. I think as I started recruiting and was placing people, one thing I realized that depending on how I position myself, often that is how I was treated, right? So if I position myself as a provider of candidates and resumes, sure, I'll be the transactional provider of candidates and resumes. If I tell them a little more of the value that I see in myself is that I'm not your everyday recruiter. I am one of the rare few people who's been a quota-carrying account executive from nearly getting fired to making club. I've experienced it all. Same thing as a sales manager from taking a team from 80% to 130% and now recruiting people. They're like, oh, you can literally hear people say, oh, so you get you get us,
right?
So you've come in at a level which is who you are, right? And the other thing I realized was that a lot of people do what they do. They work in companies and they know their customers, but they don't know what's happening in the industry. And I'm standing on the sidelines of this premiership game playing out and I can see things that they can't see.
Yeah.
So that is an incredible resource to them. So my value proposition to them is that I'm out there moment by moment having conversations with the most successful people and the ones who aren't, the most successful companies and the ones who aren't, and use me as a resource. What questions do you have? Right? So when I come and work with you, we are genuinely better together. So I'm here to help you win. I want to help them win, whether it's helping them build a great team or diagnose a situation with an underperforming salesperson, you know, should they stay or should they go, or giving them information about what best practices out there or what the state of the market is even before we transact. And so I'm always willing to have that conversation. And I think that's a 20% of the time it's a conversation which does not lead to a transaction immediately, or whether it's for their career, right? This is the situation. They've doubled my numbers, halved my team, whatever. You know, I've got a new boss. What do you think? And so we get into the conversation.
Okay, I love it. So that's the context, but then tell me the specifics of, you know, I am I right that it coincides with the pandemic, or did it predate that, this sort of transformation from a very successful search firm into almost a movement where people, like, you've got much greater visibility?
Thank you. And I did digress. So to summarize, went from just having the conversations, having more conversations with executives, listening to their problems and genuinely wanting to solve it. It may or may not result in a placement, whether it was their career or their teams. I then started writing a book. I felt that there was a need for how to find a job in 2020 as against 1990. Or, you know, I'll update my resume and go apply for jobs to a this is a social hiring generation. You know, how do you actually build your brand, connect with the right people, identify the companies that you want to work with, and really bring a digitally transformed approach to, you know, don't worry about your resume. It's the people, they're looking at your LinkedIn profile and how that's your ecosystem, which you can use to drive opportunity. So wrote the book, released the book, had no idea the pandemic would be, you know, hitting us in 6 weeks from release. And I'm like, oh, great. I can't even have a book launch and do this and that. But you know what? There were a whole bunch of people who needed help. So we shipped 200 books free. We ran 40 workshops. I recorded a course over 2 months. I had been, I love learning. So I had been following a bunch of course creators and launched a 6-hour course with workbooks, and 80% was given away free initially. And then we started looking at outplacement opportunities because we hadn't even thought of that, but there was no recruiting to be done. But we went to companies and said, you know, there is a better way to help your people leave than just firing them. And would you be open to considering giving them some outplacement support? And so that then became, that put food on the table for the team. We didn't have to, you know, I wasn't going to because we had had some buffers, but it just helped us completely work through a 12-month process with that. And then when we came out of that, I think two people who were reached out to for community awards, that's it up there from the New South Wales government, put in a nomination. And then I get an email one day saying, you need to come to New South Wales Parliament. Like, for what? And it was this committee, which was, it was nice. It was never for the award, but it's when it's done, it was just, oh, that was a moment in time when we just helped. I think it made us very compassionate recruiters, because at the end of the day, each one is they're a family. And, you know, I work with leaders, and them being out of work for 4 weeks, I know exactly how it felt when I went through it. So, yeah.
Love that. So it's Certificate of Outstanding Service from New South Wales government. That's amazing. Fantastic. But that was in recognition of what specifically? Of you helping people through the pandemic with your course, or?
Yeah. So we gave away, I ran, I think, over 50 workshops, at which there were 500 people. I taught people how to make great executive resumes, how to create LinkedIn profiles, how to make a list of target companies that they wanted to work for, how to write approaching emails, how to do well at interviews by doing, you know, what I call consultative interviewing. That was the heart of the content. And we had well over 100 people who got jobs through that process. So
fantastic. Wow.
Yeah, that was over and above paid assignments.
That's amazing. I love that. So cool. And what, by the way, I love your brand, your logo, your book, your website, everything like is very, what's the word I want? It's economical in that your messaging is very precise. And, you know, the way that you explain your value proposition on the website and everything, it's just really, really well done. What impact has the book had in terms of helping you build the business? Because that's I actually have had a few people on the show who have written a book, and it's on my bucket list but I'm intimidated by it because it seems like such an enormous, you know, project. So tell me, like, why you did it, and then what the benefit from a, you know, commercial point of view has been.
Sure. The backstory is really that for over 10 years, I've volunteered at my church, helping people find jobs. That was my area of, on Friday morning, I turn up and this is from the janitor to the CFO.
Wow.
Can't find a job. So I've had so many conversations. I always walk away. I know they were inspired, but they don't have actually skills and tools. So I've always wanted to do that. So over a period of time, I started capturing what I wanted to say to people. Yes. And then with that work, when people started getting laid off, that resulted in a book, which it took me about 8 months to write. Wrote the book. But writing a book is great because you can actually create frameworks to communicate things with clarity. And so that helped me become clear on frameworks. And so I've got basically a 4-step framework, and within each step, there are 3 frameworks. So, you know, that helps it. It's easy to action if it's not practical. So people know I'm at this stage, this is what I need to do next, and basically go from there. So, yeah.
Pri, just hold that thought. I want to hear the rest, but I want to highlight something you just said, which is so powerful. Clarity. That is the word. When I was trying to describe your brand and your website, that was the word I was looking for. There's real clarity, which is hard to achieve. It's actually easier to have lots of text and over explain things. To explain the message succinctly and powerfully with clarity is actually difficult. And you've gone through this very what I find difficult is this process of unpacking everything you know and putting it into a framework. And this is so powerful. You're developing essentially intellectual property and digital assets, which take on a life of their own. It makes it easier for not just you, but your whole team can then use this language, these models, this clear way of explaining things to with their conversations and with clients, with candidates. And so that's powerful. But secondly, these frameworks and these digital assets that you're creating have a very long tail. And if you send an email, you make a call, like I loved your E1, R1, E2, R2 model, framework, cadence, whatever you want to call it. But each of those emails has a very short tail. It disappears in people's inbox very quickly. The phone calls, you had a call conversation. There is a tail in terms of the relationship potentially, but again, people's memories are short. But when you're putting this type of content out there into the world, it has a very long tail, and it's amazing. Like, and this podcast is an example of how I'm doing that, because like, let's say that this episode, there's probably going to be about 1500 to 2000 people who listen to this, right? So wow. I try to imagine me making 1500 to 2000 cold calls. It's impossible, right? It just can't. And I'm doing that. I'm publishing this every week. So that's 2000 people every week who are, you know, getting this message, and then they're subscribing and then they're staying connected. There's a very long-term impact, which is way more than one person by themselves could possibly achieve. And so I love the fact you're doing this. Now, not everyone might write a book, but I would encourage people listening to think, how can I create intellectual capital that adds value for people even when I'm not sitting in front of them? I think that's the message I would give people.
Absolutely. And the only thing I'll add to that is that if you are looking at problems, there are, you know, if you made a list of problems that candidates said they had, is from, I'm not sure what I want in my next job. So then you build you write an atomic essay or a short blog post on how to find clarity. That's exactly what I did. So I've got this whole 4 sections on fit, number 2 on personal branding, number 3 on targeting the right employers, and number 4 on how to achieve influence at interviews. And that's all come through 60 atomic essays of 500 words each. So you've then got a 30,000-page book. You've built it modularly from the bottom up rather than thinking linear. You know, I've got to write a book. What am I going to write about? As against, make a list of all the problems that you hear. I don't know what to do with my resume. I don't know whether I should stay or should I go. And if you solve each problem at one time, and you can write a blog, you can create a checklist, you can create a little graphic, which is exactly what I've done with my book. You then have a body of knowledge that you and your team can consult on. You can deliver real value. And what we found is that if you do that as part of your day-to-day recruiting, and someone says, hey, you know, recruiting managers, the hiring manager says, I don't have roles, but I'm looking, you know, how do you think you can help me? In the past, I'd say, well, I'll keep you in mind if we have an opportunity. Today, we'll say, all right, on a scale of 1 to 10, how keen, you know, how eager are you? He said, well, I've got to go now. On that, I said, would you like to spend some time working out a strategy for yourself so that you can self-source opportunities? Not me, put them out as an NPC. That changes the relationship immediately. And that time that you spend with them, helping them with a resume, a LinkedIn profile, how to target employers, they're like, why would you do this when you made yourself redundant? And I said, at the end of the day, I want to help you in. And I don't, you know, I think people realize that we want to help.
Yeah.
And Mark, 70% of them will go on to a new role and come back and say, hey, we want to work with you guys. right?
Absolutely.
So it, yeah.
Yeah. Look, this is one of those examples of where delivering value in advance without any guarantee or even expectation of it coming back to you, ironically, it does always come back in some, not from every single person, but there is definitely a long-term payoff to that sort of behavior and that sort of approach to those relationships and those conversations. Did you want to elaborate on that?
Yes, I just wanted to finish that. So as a result of working with about 500 people in, whether it was group workshops, one-on-one calls, to and 100 paid sales VPs, CTOs, CIOs, we have so much goodwill out there in our industry. It is amazing. And that has been a tidal factor. So we literally, over the last, you know, we tripled in accounts, we tripled in the number of placements, we doubled in the staff numbers that we had. So that came back. But you're right. I have never asked someone that if I do this, will you do that? We've just, what do you need? Get it done. Make the effort. Don't, because people remember how you make them feel when they are vulnerable. And if you can connect at that level and just help and move on and keep in touch, the odd text, the odd phone call, and celebrate with them, they would want to work. But that's not why we do it. But it makes it very easy to say, hey, Mark, congratulations on your new role. You know, if you're building a team, we'd love to work with you. Why would they work with someone else?
It's absolutely genius, Pri. And the book and the, I love how, I mean, I'm going to need coaching from you when I write my book, because I love your approach of, you know, really breaking it down into bite size, you know, 500 word essays with a graphic or a checklist or some, you know, and then that then becomes the book over time. That's brilliant. But you said something powerful, which I want to leave people with. Goodwill is hard to quantify, but it is, if there's any that then becomes the book. I mean, there's a lot of problems and challenges with our industry, but there is a distinct lack of goodwill among clients, candidates, and recruiters, you know. And it's a game changer. If you can create that goodwill in the marketplace, it's indescribable how beneficial that is. And, you know, it's a term I don't hear very many people talking about. In fact, I think one of the few people in our industry I've ever heard who've even used that word goodwill. And I really want our listener to think, how can I create goodwill within my ecosystem that I serve? And there's many ways, but start thinking about that.
There's one more thing I'll add there, Mark, that we didn't talk about enough, was that all of my 10 team members, none of them have worked in recruitment. They've all worked in corporate. And I have taken the time and we've created the systems and trainings to bring them up to speed. And we have given them the time. And basically, that goodwill starts under your own roof. If we treat people well, they will stay, they will work hard for you, and they will collectively, you will earn, learn, and grow. That has been critical in replicating myself and the value proposition that I want to give, so I can have an executive speak to any one of my team members and have encountered the same values, which then makes a positive impact for them or the candidates, because it starts with the team. So I think that that has come together quite nicely, and that's a consistent experience regardless.
I love that. And look, that could be a whole separate podcast just on hiring, you know, training and retaining people and creating a culture where people have common values. That's let's say that's part two, Pri. You know, we can follow up on that another time, because that is, in and of itself, is a lot of owners fall down, and it's why they don't grow. It's because that's challenging, and it doesn't just happen automatically. You have to do it intentionally, and it takes time to put those things in place.
If there's one thing that I've learned early on, is that if I can help someone else achieve their goals, they will help me achieve my goals directly or indirectly. If I can help my team members achieve their goals and design the kind of life that they really want, I know I will achieve my goals. That's the same with the client or the candidate. And if that's just a day-to-day operating system, it does create a really good ripple effect to make a place you're happy to come to work, to have conversations that you're enjoying, to work with clients that are happy to take a call from you, whether or not they have a job. And it's a good way to live.
I love it. One final question is, Pinnacle Society is based in the US. So it's a great bunch of people who I've come to know many of them really well. But how did you get connected to, because I don't think they have an Australian chapter, do they? So you have to travel all the way to the States. That's a long way. Why did you decide to do that?
You can see by the smile of my face how much I love the Pinnacle people, right? So from Gail, Rob Bauman, Jordan Rayboy, Michael Petracht, and on and on and on. I'll close by saying this, Mark, you have made an amazing impact in this industry by just doing what you do. I can go back 10 plus, 15 plus years where, you know, I had to listen to those audio messages, and I would listen to these people and like, wow, I've just got to go and action one thing from what I've learned today. So when I got beyond that success phase, I was doing well. I knew it was good. I wanted more. And I'm like, I really need to find, it's a lonely job. It is very hard and a lonely job to be, even if you're successful, most people don't get what you do. Thankfully my wife does. And we've always talked about things, but big picture, you're just alone. And I applied to the Pinnacle Society as a outside chance because it was a US-based organization. And lo and behold, after, 16 people down to 5 people being invited to San Antonio, I was the first non-North American recruiter to be accepted. So, and that was, something that's very near and dear to my heart. So my Pinnacle family is in the US, and I'm in the US twice a year, and I relish every moment that I spend with all of these people because they're amazing human beings, leave alone recruiters. They're good people. So, yeah.
Absolutely, 100%. Are you going to San Diego in April?
I am.
Well, I will be there too, Pri. So I can't wait to see you in person after all these years and shake your hand and even give you a hug. I would love to.
I love that. Meet you. Yep. Hugs. Right. Absolutely.
Great. Okay, Pri.
That is such good news.
This has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for bringing so much value and insight to the Resilient Recruiter listeners, and look forward to meeting you in person.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it.